Welcome to the Men of God podcast. The Men of God podcast is a ministry of Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary in Owensboro, Kentucky. This is the voice of the narrated Puritan, www.puritanaudiobooks.com. In this episode of the Men of God podcast, I want to talk about the fanaticism of a man named James Davenport, who wreaked havoc during the First Great Awakening. Let's talk about his rise, progress, excesses, recovery, and retractions. There's so much to be ascertained here in the indiscreet zeal of Davenport that can be lessons learned for young pastors aspiring to the ministry. This is from Joseph Tracy's The Great Awakening to begin with, and then ended with Something Out of the Life of Asahel Nettleton by Bennett Tyler. Repeated mention has been made in the course of this history of the Reverend James Davenport of Southold, Long Island. He was a favorite of George Whitefield, who met him in New Jersey and had stood high in the opinion of the tenets. The Reverend Andrew Croswell, in a pamphlet in his defense, produced numerous testimonies in favor. For example, Mr. Whitefield declared in conversation that he never knew one keep so close a walk with God as Mr. Davenport. Mr. Tennant, in my hearing, affirmed that Mr. Davenport to be one of the most heavenly men he ever was acquainted with. Mr. Pomeroy, who is acquainted with both, thinks he does not come one whit behind George Whitefield, but rather goes beyond him for heavenly communion and fellowship with the Father and with the Son, Jesus Christ. Mr. Parsons of Lyme told me the other day, this is July 16th of 1742, that not one minister whom he had seen was to be compared to James Davenport for living near to God and having his conversation always in heaven. Mr. Owen also of Groton said that the idea he had of the apostles themselves scarcely exceeded what he saw in Mr. Davenport. In brief, there is not one minister in all of Connecticut that is zealously affected in the good cause of God at this day, but instead of slighting him, is apt to think more highly of him than we ought to think of men, and to receive him almost as if he was an angel from heaven. This is the statement of an honest partisan, so far as a partisan can be honest, not false, but too highly colored. Davenport had certainly produced wonderful effects and collected a large tribute of veneration. He rode, to use language of a more modern date, on the very top wave of the spirit of the age. More than any other man, he embodied in himself and promoted in others all the unsafe extravagances into which the revival was running, and those whose zeal outran their knowledge saw in him what they proudly hoped soon to become. And admiring the spirit of the age as it appeared in him, and admired their own spirit full grown, such a man could not fail to have a popularity, violent in his favor and vindictive against all his opposers. As he went foremost in the wrong direction, which the revival had begun to take, he was regarded by multitudes as its model man, by comparison with whom all others were to be judged. As appears from the concurrent testimony of all parties, his influence mainly brought the revival to a crisis. He led it so deeply into such errors that it ought to stop, and provoked the opposition which brought it to an end. A knowledge of his character and proceeding is therefore of the first importance to one who would understand the history of his times, and it is to be regretted that we have not as full and minute accounts of his whole life as we have of some parts of it. It is also to be regretted that nearly all we have, except indefinite praise, comes to us through his decided opponents. Still, it seems possible, by omitting all facts concerning which prejudice might mislead the witnesses, to make out a well-authenticated history of his proceedings, sufficiently complete to show their true character. For an account of the commencement of his career, we are indebted to the Reverend William Hart, pastor of the First Church in Saybrook, Massachusetts. Mr. Hart appears to have been a man of good character, moderately Calvinistic, and had been condemned by Davenport as unconverted. He learned many of the particulars from Davenport himself and others in Southold, New Jersey, which he visited perhaps for that very purpose. The account was addressed to Dr. Chauncey and appears in his work on the state of religion in New England. It seems that when the reports concerning Whitefield's labors and success first reached Long Island, both James Davenport and Barber of Oyster Ponds received him as an angel of God, and were confident that a glorious revival of religion was about to pervade the land. They betook themselves to special prayer that God would hasten the work, teach them what he was about to do, and make them eminent instruments in promoting it. From their subsequent career, it appears neither unreasonable nor uncharitable to suppose that their prayers were inspired, in part by a sincere zeal for God and for the salvation of souls, and in part by pleasing visions of their own future greatness, as imminent instruments of its promotion, though of this last element of their feelings they probably were not aware. After some time, the words in Habakkuk 2, verse 3, "For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak, it shall not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry," were strongly impressed on Barber's mind, which he took as a divine intimation that their expectations should be fulfilled. He informed James Davenport of the impression, on whom it had a similar effect. Soon after, it must have been about the beginning of March 1740, Barber sat up all, or nearly all, of Saturday night meditating on these things, and at family worship the next morning, as he was reading Psalm 102, verse 13, was impressed upon his mind. The words are, "Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favor her, yea, the set time is come." This he took as an intimation from heaven that the great revival which he had been expecting should immediately commence, and as an order to begin his labors without delay. He fainted, but recovered so as to attend public worship at the usual hour. He spent about a week in visiting and exhorting his people, telling of the wonderful discoveries that God had made to him and how he had fainted at the vision. He then left Oyster Ponds to go forth and proclaim the gospel abroad. Intending to obey a scriptural direction, he took no money, no change of apparel, nor yet shoes, but was shod with boots. He declared that he had laid aside all premeditation, being taught on every occasion directly by the Holy Ghost what he should say and where he should go. He came first to Davenport at Southhold, whose mind had been impressed with the words of Psalm 115, verses 12 to 14. "The Lord has been mindful of us. He will bless us. He will bless the house of Israel. He will bless the house of Aaron. He will bless them that fear the Lord, both small and great. The Lord shall increase you more and more, you and your children." Davenport assembled his people, and Barber addressed him in his usual style. After visiting all parts of Southhold, Barber went about 20 miles to Oldman's. Having delivered his message here, he ceased to receive the usual directions as to his course, and could do nothing while the cloud abode upon the tabernacle. He refused to preach when requested. Some of his own people visited him to urge his return, but in vain. Here he remained in idleness for several months till he grew fat and ragged. At length, after a few excursions in the vicinity, he returned to Oyster Ponds and soon proceeded to Rhode Island to meet George Whitfield. The account of their meeting was already been given in Whitfield's own words. Whitfield took him to Georgia and made him superintendent of spiritual affairs in his orphan house. After Barber's visit to Southhold, James Davenport commenced his extraordinary labors, but at first only among his own people. He assembled them at his lodgings and addressed them for almost 24 hours together. The effort overcame his strength, and he was confined for several days to his chamber. It is not improbable that the feeble state of his body, which afterwards certainly affected the soundness of his mind, had already commenced. His church seems to have been, like many others, in a bad condition, containing many unconverted members. At least he thought so, and began to make distinctions accordingly in his public treatment of them, calling those whom he esteemed regenerate brother, and the others neighbor. He soon forbade the neighbors to come to the Lord's table. This produced no little excitement, but as he believed, the divine blessing attended his preaching and measures, and about 20 of his people were converted. He came very near attempting to work a miracle. A woman in an adjoining parish had long been insane and for some time dumb. Davenport fasted and prayed for her recovery, and gave out that she would recover on a certain day that he named. On that very day she died. He claimed the event as an answer to his prayer, as she was relieved from her infirmity by being taken to heaven. This is in the summer of 1740, not far from the time when George Whitfield saw him in New Jersey and was so much pleased with his piety. Of the commencement of his itinerations, the date is lacking, but we have his own account of the principal facts as he related them to the Boston pastors in 1742. One of his brethren proposed to him to go forth and preach beyond the bounds of his own parish, but he made no reply at the time, not knowing the will of the Lord concerning it. He, however, made it a subject of prayer, and after some time, on opening his Bible, though he had no thought of turning to that passage, his eye fell on the account of the attack which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made on the Philistines. As he read, he saw every line, every word, in a new light. The Lord caused it to make a strong impression on his mind. as Jonathan and his armor bearer went to the camp of the Philistines, so the Lord called him and the man just mentioned to go to East Hampton, where they should convert as many as Jonathan and his armor bearer slew. But as Jonathan had a sign that he should not attack the garrison unless the Philistines called him, come up hither, so he must wait till he was invited to East Hampton. At length, some of the people in East Hampton said that they should like to have him come and preach to them. He went, with his friend before mentioned, up to their knees in snow. As Jonathan and his armor-bearer climbed up the hill to the Philistines on their hands and knees. The result was according to their expectation, for 20 were converted. This same man generally accompanied him in his future itinerations, as was called by Davenport and by others throughout the country, his armor-bearer. The reader must not set aside this account as a caricature. True, Dr. Chauncey was the reporter, but Davenport told the story in the presence of at least a dozen witnesses, ministers of Boston and Charleston, many of whom were staunch friends and active promoters of the revival, so that Chauncey could not have dared materially to alter the facts, even if he had been wicked enough to desire it. And the facts are of such a character that no choice of language can essentially change their appearance. In June of 1740, during a session of the Presbyterian Synod, we find Davenport at Philadelphia preaching at Society Hill with the Tenants and others. In the autumn, he joined Whitfield, who wrote in his journal October 30th on arriving at New York, "To add to my comfort, the Lord brought my dear brother Davenport from Long Island, by whose hands the blessed Jesus has of late done great things." Having parted, they met again November 5th at Baskinridge, New Jersey, where Davenport had been preaching to Mr. Cross's parishioners. Here we lose sight of him until the next spring or summer. It was on or near the 14th of July in 1741 that Davenport came from Long Island to Stonington, Connecticut. Here it was said near 100 persons were struck under conviction by his first sermon, and about that number converted in 8 days, including about 20 Indians, and that many were left under hopeful convictions. From Stonington he visited westerly Rhode Island. Of his labors there, a favorable account by Park, the missionary, has been given in a preceding chapter. The history of subsequent years shows that a considerable part of these supposed conversions among the Indians were genuine. In many of the towns in that region, he condemned the ministers as unconverted and exhorted their people to leave them. Among those whom he condemned was a venerable Eliphalet Adams of Windham, Connecticut, whose faithful labors had been a principal means of preserving the flame of piety in that region from extinction, and under whom there had been a happy revival in 1721, the period of deepest darkness in New England. Here his influence in producing alienations and divisions is said to have been peculiarly unhappy, though no particulars are given, and a report of injustice done to a man so extensively known and revered, and throughout the country. At Lyme, he was received with a qualified approbation by Parsons and Griswold, but produced no very remarkable effects. On the 25th of August, he called on Mr. Hart of Saybrook and asked if he was willing that he should preach in his pulpit. Mr. Hart, before answering, asked him if it was his practice, as reported, publicly to condemn ministers as unconverted. He replied that it was. Mr. Hart asked on what evidence he condemned them. Instead of answering that question, he stated the object for which he did it, which was for the purification of the churches and the discovery of the unconverted, that they might be avoided. In answer to other questions, he avowed that he encouraged the establishment of separate meetings of the converted and the labors of itinerant exhorters. After a vain attempt to procure some concession from him, Mr. Hart refused him the use of his pulpit. He then said to his attendants, "Come, let us go forth without the camp, after the Lord Jesus bearing his reproach. Oh, 'tis pleasant to suffer reproach for the blessed Jesus, sweet Jesus." The next day, 4 ministers, a Reverend Mr. Worthington, Knott, Beckwith, and Hart, called upon him to converse with him on his mode of proceeding, but it was found impossible to converse with him. He commenced a vehement discourse to them and would not be interrupted, lecturing them as unconverted men, blind guides, wolves in sheep's clothing, and the like, then offered a prayer partly for their conversion and partly against them, and then left them to attend a meeting which he had appointed, refusing to decide whether he would grant them an interview at any future time. He had given out before his arrival that he had a great work to do at Saybrook, but the event seems to have fallen short of his expectation. He continued his course to New Haven, calling on ministers by the way. demanding of each an account of his religious experience, and condemning all who refused to give it, or whose accounts were unsatisfactory, or who in any way opposed his movements as unconverted. He seems to have considered himself specially commissioned for this work, for he declared at Stonington that God had promised to call a number of unconverted ministers by impressing on his mind the work, "He will bless the house of Aaron." He arrived at New Haven in September. Here a general revival had commenced the preceding winter, and its influence still remained. His descent from the famous John Davenport, the first pastor of that church, his consanguinity with several respectable families, and especially his reputation for uncommon sanctity and usefulness, procured him a favorable reception. Mr. Noyes, the pastor of the church, admitted him to his pulpit, and there appears to have been no visible opposition till he pronounced Mr. Noyes an unconverted man. On this, Mr. Noyes called a meeting of several friends, September 21st, among whom were the principal officers of Yale College, to whom Davenport gave some very frivolous reasons for believing that Mr. Noyes was unconverted. The result was that he was thenceforth excluded from the pulpit. How long he continued there is uncertain, but after his departure and before the end of the year, his followers organized a separate church, which, after several years of controversy, numerous councils, and some confessions, came to be acknowledged as a regular church and still subsists and flourishes. While here there were a few instances of trances and visions among his adherents, he probably spent a winter at Southold. Among those who suffered temporary injury from the influence of his labors at New Haven, the celebrated missionary David Brainerd ought probably to be mentioned. Brainerd dated his conversion from July 12, 1739. He became a member of Yale College in September of that year. During the revival of 1741, he was much quickened and used to meet frequently with a few religious friends for unreserved and confidential religious intercourse. In the winter of 1742, a woman told President Clapp that a freshman told her that he had heard Brainerd say of somebody, "He has no more grace in this chair," and he guessed that Brainerd was speaking of some of the faculty. The words had been uttered in the hall where Brainerd and two or three others of his religious circle were conversing, and the listener was in an adjoining room. President Clapp sent for the freshman, ascertained who were conversing with Brainerd, called them and extorted from them the fact that the words were used in reply to a question, "What do you think of Tudor Whittlesey?" Mr. Whittlesey was a man whose piety there was no good reason to question. Brainerd deserved to be privately reprimanded and made to confess his fault before those who heard him commit it, but he was required to make a public confession. Disgusted with the harshness of the sentence, and with the meanness of thus ferreting out a private conversation, he refused, was expelled from college, and though powerful influence was used in his favor, never permitted to rejoin his class. He had also once attended a meeting of the Separatists, when forbidden by the rector, and it was reported, but not proved, that he had said he wondered the rector did not expect to drop down dead for finding the scholars who followed Mr. Tennant to Milford. There can be no doubt that he was guilty of improprieties of which we have no account, for he afterwards burned his diary for 13 months, including the time of his expulsion, inserting a notice at the beginning of the succeeding manuscripts that a specimen of his manner of living during that entire period would be found in the first 30 pages next following, except that he was now more refined from some imprudences and indecent heats than before, in quote Jonathan Edwards' Life of Brainerd. He died in October 9th of 1747. Jonathan Edwards thought him less careful of life and health than duty required, and the inquiry deserves attention how far the false views of duty into which this revival led him, and which led him into imprudences and indecent heats, continued to influence him and hurried him to his grave. On the 29th of May, 1742, two persons, Captain Blacklatch and Samuel Adams of Ripton Parish in Stratford, Connecticut, came to Hartford, where the General Assembly was in session, and filed their complaint with the Secretary, stating that James Davenport had arrived there about 10 days before, and Benjamin Pomeroy soon after, and that with certain illiterate persons, exhorters, they were collecting assemblies of people, mostly children and youth, and under pretense of religious exercises, were inflaming them with a bad spirit, and with doctrines subversive of all law and order, by which the peace of the town was greatly disturbed. A warrant was therefore issued, and Davenport and Pomeroy were brought before the assembly on the 1st of June. The investigation of the case occupied a considerable part of 2 days. It appeared from the testimony that he preached, prayed, and exhorted with even more than his usual vehemence of language and gesture, denounced ministers as unconverted without reserve, and urged a duty of all to sustain the work in defiance even of the commands of parents or the laws of the colony. The assembly at this very session had enacted a law for regulating abuses and correcting disorders in ecclesiastical affairs. This law was intended to repress by civil penalties the practices of itinerants and exhorters. It was a high-handed infringement of the rights of conscience, and in a few years fell and buried the party which enacted it in its ruins. This is a law which he exhorted his hearers to set at defiance. And seldom, it must be acknowledged, has a more plausible occasion been found in New England for preaching disregard of law. He also professed to have been taught by the Spirit that the end of the world was near. He knew not the exact time, but it was very near. At the close of the first day of his examination, when the assembly adjourned in the evening, as the sheriff was conducting him to his lodgings, he stopped on the front doorsteps of the meeting house where the session seems to have been held, and began to exhort the great crowd that had collected. The sheriff took hold of his sleeve to lead him away. He exclaimed, "Lord, thou knowest somebody's got hold of my sleeve. Strike them, Lord, strike them." Pomeroy cried out, "Take heed how you do that heaven-daring action." Their partisans rushed in to resist the sheriff. Others refused to aid him and called upon. For a while the crowd and the tumult increased, and it seemed that the sheriff would be overpowered. But taking advantage of a little relaxation of the pressure, he effected his retreat with his prisoners, the disappointed multitude saying as they went, "We will have 5-1 on our side tomorrow." A mob collected around the gentleman's house where the prisoners were lodged, and it was 2 hours before the magistrates could disperse it. Sounds of excited devotion were heard in all parts of the town nearly all the night, and in the morning a militia force of 40 armed men was ordered out to protect the assembly from insult and interruption. This guard was kept on duty till this business was concluded and seems to have been prevented any further public disturbance. Now there's a lot more to this story in Joseph Tracy's The Great Awakening, but to bring this to a close, I want to insert part of what is written by Bennett Tyler in a footnote on James Davenport in the life of Asahel Nettleton. From Bennett Tyler, The Disorders and Fanaticism of James Davenport. There is a very good account of these disorders in an old pamphlet containing 9 sermons by the Reverend Joseph Fish, pastor of a church in Stonington, preached in 1763. He seems to have been a sound and faithful minister of the gospel. He was the pastor of a large and flourishing church which had shared richly in the revival of 1740, but his parish was one of the theaters of Davenport's operations. The result of which was, as he informs us in his preface, that not less than 2/3 of his congregation withdrew from his ministry and formed themselves into separate societies. The sermons were preached 20 years after these separations took place, and their object was to make the youth of his flock acquainted with the scene through which their church and society had passed. As his pamphlet is but little known at the present day, and as the facts which it contains are well worthy to be preserved, I have thought it might be useful to make a few extracts. About 23 or 24 years ago, there was the most wonderful work of God that ever was known in this part of the world, both for the extent of it and visible appearance. It seems there was a general thoughtfulness about religion prevailing in the minds of the people before they made it manifest by word. The ministers of Christ were stirred up to preach with uncommon zeal and solemnity, and the people were as ready to hear with unusual attention, while the things of eternity were charged home to the conscience. The work went on gloriously. The standing ministers, there being no other than in the land, became more abundant and fervent in their labors as they saw their people were attentive to hear. Nor did they labor in vain. Scarce a sermon could be preached, but the hearts of the people more or less would be touched, and some deeply affected. While we were thus engaged in religion, a new and surprising scene opened upon us. Even such religious operations and appearances as engaged both the careless and the serious to come and see and hear for themselves. In these strange operations, there was a marvelous mixture of almost everything good and bad, truth and error, chaff and wheat. For while the Spirit of God wrought powerfully, Satan raged maliciously and acted his old subtle part to deceive. This happened, or at least is carried to the highest pitch, under the preaching and ministrations of a wonderful, strange, good man, the Reverend James Davenport of Long Island, who visited these parts in a time of our religious concern and awakening. A young man of undoubted zeal and piety for God, love to souls, and real ardent desire to advance the Redeemer's kingdom. But, thus it was permitted, a man while with us, under the powerful influence of a false spirit, and a great part of his conduct, as many then told him, and as he himself did afterwards acknowledge with deep abasement, Satan taking the advantage of his zeal in religion, transformed himself into an angel of light, and hurried him into extremes, yea, artfully carried him beside the truth and duty, and beyond the bounds of decency. The things promoted by him that were evidently and dreadfully wronged are such as these. He not only gave an unstrained liberty to noise and outcry, both of distress and joy in time of divine service, but promoted both with all of his might. Those persons that passed immediately from great distress to great joy and delight, which 'tis true have their place in religion, after asking them a few questions, were instantly proclaimed converts, or said to have come to Christ. And upon it the assembly were told that a number, it may be 10 or 15, have come to Christ already. Who will come next? When I desire to speak it with sorrow, numbers of such converts in a little time returned to their old way of living, were as carnal, wicked, and void of Christian experience as ever they were. Again, he was a great favorer of visions, trances, imaginations, and powerful impressions upon the mind and others, and made such inward feelings a rule of his conduct in many respects. Especially if the impression came with a test of Scripture, which he looked upon to be open to him at such a time and in such cases, pointing out his duty, which he would accordingly pursue. Upon such powerful impressions and opening to Scripture, he went to Boston, strongly persuaded that multitudes in that great city, to use his own expressions, would be converted by his preaching there. But as Jonathan Edwards rightly observes, such circumstances attending religious affections are no sure sign that they are gracious or truly religious. He was a great encourager, if not the first setter up of public exhorters, not restricting them to the gospel rule or order of brotherly exhortations, but encouraging any lively, zealous Christian so reputed to exhort publicly, in full assemblies, with all the air and assurance of ministerial authoritative exhorting. Although they were exceedingly raw and unskillful in the word of righteousness, and altogether unequal to the solemn undertaking. However, they, being very warm and zealous, spake boldly and freely, which qualities of speech, by the way, Jonathan Edwards judiciously observes, are no sure signs of gracious religious affections, and so were highly esteemed, had an admiration, and preferred before the letter learned rabbis, scribes, and Pharisees, and unconverted ministers, which phrases a good man would frequently use in his sermons, with such peculiar marks not only of odium but of indication, as served to beget a jealousy in many of the people's minds, that their ministers were the letter learned unconverted teachers which he aimed at. And thus the exhorters came into credit among multitudes of people who chose rather to hear than their old teachers, which served directly to puff them up with spiritual pride and fitted them for the daring undertaking which followed. By these means, the standing ministers began to fall in their credit and esteem among the people, especially among such as were reckoned the foremost Christians, many of whom were the bloated exhorters, and they began to treat their ministers with such assurance, haughtiness, and contempt, as plainly spoke their sentiments that they knew more and better how to teach than they, especially if the ministers opposed them or only questioned whether they were right. And thus the seeds of discord and disunion were sown, and a foundation laid for after separations. But what tended more effectually than all that has been said to prepare the way for separation was this, followed. This zealous good man, from a sense hopefully at first of the imminent danger of an unconverted ministry, both to themselves and the people, was betrayed by the false spirit into that bold, daring enterprise of going through the country to examine all the ministers in private, and then publicly to declare his judgment of their spiritual state. And this he did whenever he could be admitted to examine them. Some that he examined, though for aught that appeared as godly as himself, were pronounced in his public prayers immediately after examination to be unconverted, and they who declared this design and practice of his to be unscriptural, and so refused to be examined by him, were sure to suffer the same fate. They were condemned by him as Christless, or which amounted to as much with the populace, he would declare that he had reason to fear they were unconverted, in which cases he would ordinarily have no other ground or reason for his fear than that of their refusing submission to his tribunal. Many good people, thinking highly of James Davenport as though he was authorized from heaven to proceed in this manner, and at the same time having great regard for their own ministers, seemed even as much concerned lest they should not stand the trial, when examined, as if they were going before the judge of all the earth. Now the counsel of the strange man, which he counseled in those days, was like the counsel of Ahithophel, as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God. Multitudes of honest good people believed everything that he said, and had such a veneration for all that he did, that if they could quote the word and example of Davenport, 'twas enough with them to justify any of the wild, unscriptural notions and ways which they through weakness had run into, so that a minister could not gainsay or correct them, under the price of his reputation. The things which I have mentioned, to which many more doubtless might be added, were such manifest errors that even the carnal and ungodly world could not but see and know they were wrong. And so in this they agreed with some judicious good people and discerning ministers who opposed him as such. And for this reason the good and the bad were ranked together, and frequently run upon by those who were zealous for these, and declared to be opposers of the work of God, and on the enemy's side. He that speaks to you, being an eye and an ear witness to all, or the substance of what has been related, is the more free in declaring these things unto you. Having gone on a year or more, if I mistake not, in the practices above stated, he was by the gentle treatment and earnest expostulation of some pious and judicious ministers, put upon serious reflection and close examination of his strange conduct in these things, which have been related, and others similar to them. And after some months' deliberation and earnest seeking to the Father of Lights, he was deliberately, clearly, and fully convinced of his errors. The mask was thrown aside. The delusions of Satan appeared to him in their own horrid light, and the dreadful consequences of his awful mistakes filled him with deep concern. He was made sensible of the injury he had done to ministers and churches, how he had broke the order of the gospel by causing divisions and offenses, and on the whole that he had brought reproach on the glorious work of God, and endangered the souls of men. For these things he was deeply abased, humbled himself before the Lord, and lay in the dust. Upon this he returned and visited many of the places where he had so grievously erred and offended, to see if he might by any means repair the damage he had done. When he came to this town, it was with such a mild, pleasant, meek, and humble spirit, broken and contrite, as I scarce ever saw exceeded or even equaled. He not only owned his fault in private, and in a most Christian manner asked forgiveness of some ministers whom he had before treated amiss, but in a large assembly made a public recantation of his errors and mistakes, and particularly mentioned and declared against some, if not all, that I exposed in this narrative, as well as others that I have not mentioned. He gave a full and solemn testimony to the work of God that was carried on in the land by the outpouring of his blessed Spirit in those things that were really and properly God's work, and said that he doubted not but that he, though, as he added, most unworthy, had been made an instrument for the saving good of many souls. But he declared with all humility and openness of heart that in many things such as above he had grievously erred. He told us how the Lord had led him to a sight of his errors, and convinced him fully that he had been under the powerful influence of the false spirit, though in the time of its operation he verily thought 'twas the Spirit of God in a high degree. Thus the good man, no longer the noisy, boisterous, rash, and censorious James Davenport, but the meek, humble, and fervent man of God, confessed, bewailed, and warned against the error which he had unhappily spread and promoted. How great and happy the change, but how he is now received and hearkened to by those zealous people who in the time of his wilderness and false zeal were ready to adore him? Why, verily, that they were not convinced of their own and his former mistakes, were far from being pleased by his present conduct. They saw that he was turned against them, that is, against some of their darling principles and ways, and thought that he was now become their enemy, and no things in which he was only told them the truth. They now looked upon him to be cold, dead, and lifeless, that he had got away from God and joined in a great measure with the world of opposers and carnal ministers. In a word, they were sadly disappointed, sorely vexed, or disquieted in their spirits, grievously offended, that is, numbers of them, and on the whole they all rejected his message.